This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
By the Book on BFM 89.9.
Hello, everyone. You are listening to By the Book with Lee Chui Lin and Sharmila Gunnison.
So today we're speaking with Yang Zi Chu, whose debut novel, The Ghost Bride, told the story of a young Chinese woman who finds herself the would-be bride of a dead man and sort of takes these twists and turns through historical fiction to folklore and ghost story to romance and mystery.
It's a lot.
It's also going to be adapted to be a 6-episode Netflix series.
And Yang Zi's second book, The Night Tiger, actually has a similar sort of intertwining quality to it of, you know, two stories of a girl working in a dance hall in 1930s Malaya, an orphaned boy working in a doctor's household, trying to keep a promise. And then it involves tigers and severed fingers and the afterlife. Yang Zi joins us on the phone now. Hi, Yang Zi. So your first book was actually in the YA genre. What prompted you to move to adult novels?
Oh, actually, my first book was also in the adult general fiction. It came out as general fiction in the U.S., but I had a different publisher for the U.K. market, and they said, let's give it a try as YA. And that's why both the U.S. and the U.K. sell into Malaysia and Singapore. So you probably get two versions. You get the U.K. version, which is a YA version of The Ghost Bride, and then there was also the general book club one.
But I can kind of understand why Ghost Bride was sold as YA, and because there is this sort of fascination with young people, which exists in Night Tiger as well. Is that something that you are drawn to telling stories about?
When I was setting up the novel, I did think, to a certain degree, there's a reason why a lot of books, especially featuring girls, have younger protagonists. Because in those days, it was very hard for women to get around. And by the time you were 19 or so, you'd likely be married, you know, have children, have a whole bunch of other things. So that was one of the plot points I considered. I did actually want to make both my heroines a little bit older, because I'm a middle-aged auntie myself. But I did think, you know, in terms of plot points and historical accuracy, you would likely already have been married if you wait too long.
And on that note, one thing that I did notice was that the main character in The Night Tiger, Ji Lin, is one who, as you say, right, lives in a time where women don't have much agency or upward mobility outside of marriage or even the ability to move around that freely. And yet she's very stubborn. She's very ambitious. She has a lot of hopes and dreams of her own. She frequently kind of just goes against the advice of others in pursuit of her own goals. Was this important for you to represent?
Yes, I think so. I think when you're writing a novel, you know, you try to make the main character as interesting as possible. And I also thought at that time there's so many stories of women who were just really frustrated. And I remember growing up and listening to my mom and her talk about various people, various aunties. And some of the stories are really sad, you know, things like being sent back to China as somebody's daughter-in-law, like being pulled out of school or being married off to someone that you didn't like, and then maybe leaving home because there was no divorce at the time and becoming, you know, setting up your own shop or becoming a vegetable seller. And I thought these women went through so much. It was very hard to choose. You know, choosing or not doing what was expected took a tremendous effort. And I thought that was interesting. The other thing that sparked my imagination was these stories of these Chinese dance halls in the 20s, in the 30s, and into the 40s and onwards. And that was I came across a historical account of one written by a British traveler, and I thought, who are these women who are working in these dance halls? You know, what sort of lives do they lead? Clearly, it wasn't really a job of not a terribly reputable job.
You know, on that note, actually, one of the things that I think makes both Night Tiger and Ghost Bride interesting to people not just from Malaysia but around the world is that it is set in a context that isn't yet represented very well in literature. In Night Tiger's case, that's 1930s Malaya. You know, is there a particular reason why these are the settings that you are drawn to?
They say that the past is another country. And when I was growing up, as you know, as you accurately say there's not a great deal about Malaysia in like the late 1800s and the 1920s and 30s. I read a lot of books by Somerset Maugham and it was always from the point of view, it was a completely different point of view. It was a British point of view of what Malaya was like. And when I read them, I always wondered, what were the local people doing? You know? So my mum had told me, my mum had had a friend who'd been a servant in an Englishman's house, and she's like, oh, these things happened, this. And I thought, it's a little bit like a mini version of Downton Abbey in which the servants know exactly what's going on, right? they know who's doing what and who's having an affair with whom. But we don't really get their perspective very much. And so I was really drawn to that time, you know, the kind of upstairs, downstairs separation, not just by class, but also by, foreigners versus local people and even language. So a British doctor like William Acton would probably have no idea what his servants were saying. Maybe in front of him. I thought that was interesting.
Well, that's the thing that struck me in reading the novel, which was that there was a definite sensitivity in terms of the relationships that emerge between the people who were at the time colonizers, right? I mean, because this is Malaya and it was under British rule. So there is a sensitivity there in terms of the relationships between the expat community, so to speak, and the locals. How did you negotiate that?
You know, I didn't really think it through in that sense. I came up with some characters, and in my mind, they became like real people. And then when I started writing, I tend to write by the seat of my pants. it just seemed to me like this person in this situation would probably have done this. You know, this was within his character or her character to make the following decisions. And, of course, context matters, you know, and that's very true, too. Within a historical context, what would have been possible, what would have not been possible, and that's something I always try to keep in mind, especially when writing about a time that is now past.
Mm. And so when you do write about a historical setting, do you aim for accuracy or were you going more for mood and feel and, you know, those sorts of things?
That's a great question. I think we try to go for everything. You know, mood, everything. It's mood and it's feeling and also has to be accurate, you know, as much as possible. I don't know whether you've ever read a book and then suddenly hit something and thought, that's not true. Atari did not come out with this computer game in 1984. You know, it totally throws you out of the world. And I feel like writing a novel, reading a novel, is sort of like being carried along in a dream. It is an immersive experience. And once the dream breaks, it's like that feeling, you know, when you're asleep and you think, I'm having a dream, right? Suddenly everything changes and you start to look at things differently. So I think as a novelist, it is our job to keep you dreaming. And so as not to introduce very jarring things like, oh, motorbike or, you know, something like that. I had to look up lots and lots of stuff. But I think that's also the fun of a historical novel, you know, discovering the past as well.
You mentioned that you had to look things up. And I would imagine that just in the gamut of the novel, because it's not just the historical setting, right? It's also the mythology that you're playing with. How much research did you do and how did you decide what you wanted to use and what you wanted to sort of, okay, this doesn't really serve my purposes. I'm going to have to gently ignore it or respectfully ignore it. Did that happen?
Oh, you know, another great question. I think when you're doing research for a time period, you have to know the time period pretty well, you know, and the area as well, in order to move the characters in it. Otherwise, I think if you don't know what's going on, the reader doesn't know, and everything feels very cloudy and insubstantial. So I did a lot of extra research. In fact, my table at home was piled with lots of ghoulish books, things like tiger killings, how many tigers there were, man-eaters of Malaya, you know, stuff like that. Lots of detail, for example, on tigers alone so that I could get the right details in, like how did they trap them, how many were there. The interesting thing is, actually, in Malaysia, even at the time, there were more leopards than tigers. and more people were killed by leopards. But nobody, somehow being taken by a leopard was never that, I don't know how, never that cool. even then, there are historical notes saying that we probably think this was a leopard, but everyone wants to say it's a tiger. So I put that in as well, and especially also the details of the fact that they like to take dogs. You know, people would lose their dogs all the time to leopards mostly and not tigers. So lots of extra detail. And you're right, one has to be somewhat judicious because at a certain point you realize, well, maybe the reader doesn't really need to know how they made. I actually had to remove large sections of the book because another thing that I enjoyed a lot was the colonial cuisine. You know, they ate really strange things. I think one could write an entire book. Because I remember when I was a little kid, you know, there was always a sort of standard colonial breakfast. You know, in these old hotels in Malaysia, which had baked beans, toast, you know, some kind of sausage, and it was kind of like a local version of an English breakfast, and that's why we've got things like roti john and stuff. And I thought, where does this come from? And I actually went down another rabbit hole of looking up old recipes and the way that they were written. You know, they're written without any really standardized measurements, so you'd get things like, take a teacup of coconut water. I'd be like, whose teacup? How big is your teacup? You know, so this is, knowing that, I actually wanted to write lots more. There were a lot of more eating scenes. There was an entire scene in which Ren makes an omelette on a charcoal stove, which is challenging. And as you can see, I'm going on. But my editor was like, oh, okay, we don't really need this. Let's get rid of this. Why are they always eating and drinking? There's a lot of extra detail that doesn't go into the book, but is there in your backstory, I think.
We're speaking today to Yang Zichu, author of The Night Tiger. Up next, we continue our conversation about historical detail and weird tigers. Keep it here on By the Book, BFM 89.9.
Beyond Frivolous Matters, BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
You are listening to By the Book with Lynn and Sharmila. On the phone with us today is Yang Zichu, author of The Ghost Bride and The Night Tiger, and we're talking about the latter today.
So earlier, Yangzi, you were telling us about the research that you did for Colonial Malaya and all the details that you found. You obviously have a great love and fascination for these details and for these stories that kind of have their root in the past. You know, are your own reading and writing influences sort of, do they mirror that?
Yes, I think so. Well, partly it's because when I was a kid and I was growing up, I didn't have many books. So I lived... part of my childhood was spent in Malaysia and also in Germany and Japan. And it was very hard to get hold of English books. The only English books that I could find were these Victorian novels. So, and I read them again and again because there was nothing else to read. That and also this stack of old National Geographic magazines that my dad took with them. We took them everywhere. And that's probably why you also see a lot of animals in the books. So I think when I started, actually when I wrote The Ghost Bride, I didn't really think it would get published, but I was actually writing it as a Gothic novel. It was my attempt at a Victorian Gothic novel, except written from the Chinese point of view.
While we've been talking about the book, I mean, we've wandered through a lot of genres, and the book itself somewhat does that. I mean, it's a romance, there are fantastical elements, it's a historical fiction, there's also a detective novel element in it. Which ones of all these disparate strands came first?
You know, I think I would actually call it strange tales. And you're right, like it does cross genres, and later on I learned that crossing genres is actually not a good thing. They like to be able to generally say, like, oh, pitch your book, like this book is a blah blah, you know, this one goes into that. It is somewhat difficult to cross genres. But I've always been fascinated by what you would probably call strange tales. And when I was a kid, again, going back to the lack of books, there was this book that I read by Pu Songling. It's like called Strange Tales from a Chinese Studio. And it's all these stories about ghosts and foxes and, you know, snake spirits and stuff, which is kind of a local, like a mythology. And I was always drawn to that. So when I started writing both books, you know, The Ghost Bride and The Night Tiger, they both start off as strange things. And from there, they can veer into other things. Like, so The Night Tiger, for example, exists both as a straightforward murder mystery and also as a ghost story. And they sort of run parallel through the book, along with the fact that they're dual narratives. And I hope at the end that the reader can feel like, well, there is a logical explanation for, you know, whodunit, and there's also some kind of spiritual satisfaction. There is a spiritual answer for the kind of ghostly elements of the book.
And speaking of that ghostly element, that duality, with the Harimau Jadian, there was actually a passage that I sort of read and then reread because I found it so intriguing. And it was this idea that the were-tigers are either men who wear the skins of tigers or tigers who wear the skins of men, and sort of which one is worse and which one's more horrifying. And I found this really intriguing and it stayed with me for a while. What does the tiger, and conversely the were-tiger, the Harimau Jadian, what do they both represent in the book?
You know, I'm smiling because I think it's so great that we're talking about weird tigers. People were like, you know, when I was writing this book, people were like, what is this book about? And I'd say, well, it's about these weird tigers. And then they'd all take a step back and say things. Oh, you're writing horror, are you? So it is, but I think it is very fascinating. The idea of shape-shifting and not knowing, you know, I think it is a basic human curiosity of wondering about other people. Like, who are you? Where did you come from? What are you planning to do? And the question of the shapeshifter occurs in all cultures. I did, as you mentioned, also find it intriguing that, you know, in the West, the werewolf is a man who changes into a wolf and goes out and kills and eats. But in Southeast Asia, the were-tiger, the Harimau Jadian, particularly is a reverse. It is an animal that wears a human skin. And that is so horrifying in many ways, right? And shapeshifters also transgress a lot of norms. You know, you're not really supposed to go around killing and eating other people. So I think it makes us all very uneasy. You know, the question of what exists and what really doesn't, and what is somebody else's motivation. So I think there's also the Confucian question of what makes us human, you know, what makes us truly human, and what distinguishes man from beast. And that's a universal question of what is humanity. It's no coincidence that one of the main characters, Ren, is named after benevolence, which is supposed to be one of the greatest virtues, one of the things that sets us apart.
Folklore and mythology is often used, as you just said, to reflect on very human experiences and very human questions. But until very recently, most of literature tends to do that from a very Western folklore perspective. You know, what was the sort of feeling or the excitement for you in terms of now drawing from mythology that is perhaps not very familiar to the rest of the world?
I'm really excited about it. You know, I think that these stories are familiar to us from this part of the world, and it is a little surprising to find that it's so strange to other people. So the whole idea of animals becoming human, you find all across Asia. You know, not in India, they have tigers, and in China and Japan, there are fox women. And I think part of it is also this almost idea of reincarnation, you know, of becoming something else that we sort of accept. And people are actually quite delighted, you know. It's sort of like, you know, someone who's grown up on the Norse myths or the Greek myths to say, wow, I didn't know that all this was going on as well. I think it's been quite a delight.
So we've been talking about The Night Tiger, of course. Is it too soon to ask you what's next? You know, what do you have on the horizon?
Yeah, you know, I am working on another novel. I don't quite know what it's about, and that's really sort of scary for me. But as I said, you know, I write by the seat of my pants, so and I'm a very slow writer. I've been told that I need to hurry up. It can't take, like, another 5 years to write a book. So I'm feeling my way through it. And I am working on something, but I'm not quite sure where it is. Just like The Night Tiger started out as a book with a first scene, and so did The Ghost Bride, both of them started off as scenes in my mind of odd things happening. You know, going back to the thought of strange tales. So in The Ghost Bride, I had this picture in my head of this girl and in the evening sitting by an oil lamp and saying, my father has asked me to be a ghost bride. You know, and you're left thinking, what? You know, so what happened? And with a Night Tiger, I had a similar feeling. I had this picture in my head of an old man who's dying, and he asks his child servant, who's literally a child of 11, to do something that is quite sad and gruesome. And that made me also go like, oh, what? Okay. So I've started with another scene like that, but I'm not quite sure where it will go. Hopefully it'll go somewhere interesting.
Well, on that note, you know, it is interesting times for you because you've got the Netflix show of Ghost Bride about to come out. How are you feeling about that?
Oh, I'm very excited. You know, I am so excited, and so, you know, I was gobsmacked when they said, hey, we might want to turn this into, you know, a series. I was very, very delighted because I think Netflix has done some wonderful programming and they're developing more original content internationally. So I was in Singapore in March. I went to visit the production and it was very cool. I can't wait for it to come out. I think the story will be slightly different because they're making it into a series. But it should be very exciting.
Yangzi, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. That was Yangzi Chu, author of The Ghost Bride and The Night Tiger, chatting with us about her work. Come to Footnotes, as we always do, the section of the show where we drop in things like recommendations, but also news, which is where we find ourselves today. So this comes off of an article from the New York Times, which basically tells the story of a few different authors and the challenges that they faced in terms of, well, getting published, getting a firestorm reaction to certain sensitive elements within the story, and then, well, the reactions that happened from there. So specifically focusing on one author, Amelie Wenzhao.
Yeah, so this is actually something that brewed, I think, particularly within the young adult book scene.
Yes.
So Amelie Wenzhao is a would-be author, I suppose. She hasn't actually been published. Her debut novel called Blood Air was 6 months away from publication when earlier this year she actually pulled it from releasing. And this was because sometime in January, I think, a lot of the online early readers of the book argued that her depiction of slavery in the novel was racially insensitive.
So we should say, I guess, that she was writing with that in mind to a degree, but it wasn't slavery, I suppose, it was more
indentured labor?
Correct. Yeah. And I think more to do with modern slavery and how indentured labor continues to be a part of many societies, particularly, as you might guess, I think from her surname, in Asian societies.
Yes.
And not necessarily in the context of American history. However, there was a pretty strong reaction to it. Where we're at now is she asked her publishers to stop. And then after revisiting it, she's decided to go ahead.
She's made, I think, some changes. But yes, so it's back in public. It's going to be released. And I think this has now created a second wave of backlash with people saying, well, if you thought it was worthy of being pulled back earlier, then, you know, why are you publishing it now? And as with most things online, it has actually turned into a bit of a pylon with, you know, commenters who haven't even read the book having thoughts on why the book is racist. And I suppose it started a conversation which mirrors a conversation that's been happening for a while in the literary world about this question of gatekeeping, I suppose.
I was going to say a lot of this has to do with woke culture. And yeah. I think the idea, there is a question here, I think, of if something is insensitive, does it mean then that it should never be read? Or does it mean that it should be read and critiqued? Because what happened here, of course, was that it was not read.
No.
And the idea was that it is not, it should not ever be read because it is so offensive or because it's just so wrong. And then, I mean, when we were talking about this, I think you brought up Lolita.
Yes.
For example.
Yeah.
Which would just not make it today, would it?
Absolutely not. And I got that, that came to mind because I read another article which sort of talked about all of these supposed books which would never get published in today's age. And one of them was Lolita. Another one was American Psycho. And the idea being that because of this sort of immediate reaction that the online world now is able to give, that a lot of publishers and perhaps even authors themselves would not want to risk putting so much work into something and then having it basically pulled before anyone can even read it.
Yes, and you mentioned the fact that this is happening within the YA genre, and that's really important to focus on here as well, because the YA genre is a particularly active one online.
Yes,
and
definitely.
It's a tight-knit community. It is one where there is a lot of support, but there is also a lot of this, right? And so it is a lot to do also with online reactions to things, mm-hmm. And online reactions to cherry-picked elements of plot. You know, this isn't even about writing. This is about plot.
Yeah, and also the fact that a few people read the book, so it were early readers, early reviewers, but largely the reaction that was coming, sort of this outsized dislike of the author and dislike of what she's writing about, isn't based on the book at all. It's based on someone's read of the book. And that's where, to me, some of the problems with this lie, because I'm not saying it's okay or that it's acceptable in any way for people to either culturally appropriate or misrepresent people's cultures, and arguably that's another much larger discussion. But I'm unsure as to whether we want to be at a place where we don't get to see and decide. We don't get to have even access to decide.
I think books should be made available. And after that, if you want to critique and react to mm-hmm. it, if it affects the sales of the book, then you live with it, right? Because it is a publication. Mm-hmm. It is something that at least you are reacting to based on what the book actually contains. Whereas this now is a reaction basically to Twitter. You know, that's
yeah.
all it is.
Yeah.
It's just you read a tweet and you go, oh my goodness, this person has no place writing a book. And then you react to that. Mm. And then people react to you calling you a fascist. You know, and then from there, it just sort of explodes into this.
And the conversation's not about the book anymore. It becomes about issues that are sort of imposed onto the book.
Correct. And neither of us have read this book. I mean, it's not out yet. I haven't even read snippets of it or anything. Like I said, I'm not defending the quality of it. I'm certainly not defending if, in fact, it turns out to have people saying things like massa, you know, things like that. If it turns out to be just really horrific when it comes to its depiction of slavery, then of course we will talk about it on the show and we will critique it. But the point is, we have to have read it to get to that point.
So the reason this particular example sort of, I think, caught so many people's attention was because largely the kind of authors who have been subjected to this sort of backlash have been white authors, right? With people of color or other minority sort of minority communities reacting to what they perceive to be appropriation or writing outside of their immediate experiences. But in this case, the writer was an Asian, a writer of Asian origin. So another woman of color herself, arguably many intersecting minorities there, and writing from what she thought and says were her own experiences relating to Asia, to China. And when she got targeted in that same way, I think was when people started saying, has this gone too far?
Not even has this gone too far, but where is this going even? You know, in what direction are people just, is it reacting for reaction's sake?
Mm-hmm.
Another person who featured in this is an author named Kosoko Jackson.
Right.
Who had a story set in the 90s during the Kosovo War featuring two gay American teenagers. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people reacted to the idea that a war in another country was being used as a backdrop for a love story, which
right.
is an understandable reaction. But he is also a gay black writer and also somebody who was in turn a sensitivity reader.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I can't decide whether it is that you and I, our outrage meter, isn't calibrated appropriately.
Also, Kosoko Jackson, was one of the ones who criticized Blood Air.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So it's just this sort of weird space where I feel like I should be on one side of the argument, but
I feel like you are. I mean, I pretty firmly am. I think that if someone writes something, if you want to cancel someone, right? Mm. So this, what's happening here is people are being cancelled before they're being published.
Yeah.
And I understand that publication is a privilege, and you do, I guess, quote-unquote, take up room, right, that could conceivably go to another less problematic book, assuming that your book is, in fact, problematic. I get all that. But I also think that you're probably being published. Someone saw something in that story, whether it's just marketability
yes.
or a good story. The point is, there is something within that manuscript mm-hmm. that somebody said, oh, this would make a good book. I would like to have the choice to read those books.
Yeah.
And I would like to have the choice to decide what I should be outraged over.
And I don't want to read books that are only considered non-problematic, because if we leave that decision to publishers and the people who pay the bills, ultimately we're just going to get really vanilla, anodine-type books, which are, who don't offend anyone, who hit all the common denominators. And I don't think that makes for good literature at all.
No, I don't want to read a book that is inclusive for the sake of being published.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that's really where we land. But let us know what you think. We're talking, of course, about the controversy surrounding Blood Air by Amelie Wen Zhao, a book that was pulled off of publication because of what people said were problematic depictions of slavery. Now it's going to go ahead. So yeah, just what is going on with this culture of cancellation and reaction
and calling out literature before it's even been read?
Exactly. Weigh in if you'd like. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio. And you have been listening to By the Book, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.